the one podcast that lives at the intersection of religion and pop culture. With me today is Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia. Hey, Betsy, tell us who you are and what you're up to these days.
Hey, Greg. I am actually at a moment of transition. I'm a school chaplain by trade. And so I've been serving in, this is my second Episcopal school. And so I've now moved to a boarding school environment here at Episcopal High School, where I'm going to be working with 9th through 12th graders and navigating the waters of living with my congregation as a dorm parent of 50 girls.
With us from Omaha, Nebraska, Liz Easton. Say, hey, Liz, what are you up to?
Hi. I live here in Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm the canon to the ordinary for the Episcopal Diocese of Nebraska, which is a title that I'm still seeking to define for the people who ask me what it means. But basically it means that I work in our diocesan office and help our parishes and people with issues ranging from calling a new priest to their church to navigating the ordination process, growing their parishes, everything. And basically it means I get paid to take road trips all across the beautiful state of Nebraska, which is like my favorite thing.
If nobody's following you on Instagram right now, they should.
Thank you. Diocese_of_Nebraska.
And finally, from Emporia, Kansas, it's Chris Arnold. Chris, say hello. What are you doing these days?
Hello, intertubes. I am serving as a parish priest in Emporia, Kansas, which is in east central Kansas, about halfway between Topeka and Wichita. It's beautiful here. The cicadas are just coming out. Very happy.
Finally, my name is Greg Knight. I'm the Director of Children and Youth Ministries in Palm Beach, Florida. It's gorgeous. It's the place to be for anyone that's looking for a place. In the interest of full disclosure and for the sake of transparency, this is a show where we talk about television, movies, books, anything that exists in the pop culture, and that means the entirety of the art, however it presents itself. So, as Dante would say, abandon all of your spoiler hang-ups, ye who enter. This is a spoiler zone. Recently, the Emmy nominations were released, and one of the things that I thought was really interesting that came out of the Emmy nominations were two shows in particular, two Netflix shows. House of Cards got a bunch of Emmy nominations, and Orange is the New Black got a lot of Emmy nominations, which is an interesting way to think about it, because Emmy tends to be the last bastion of old television, holding up that banner of, well, let's make sure network shows get promoted, and let's make sure, you know, shows that are on terrestrial television get promoted. And here come these internet shows along who have built up quite the following, and they can't be ignored. And so we're not going to ignore them today. Our first topic is going to be Orange is the New Black. It is the story of Piper Chapman, a woman in her 30s who was sentenced to 15 months in prison after being convicted of a decade-old crime of transporting money for her drug-dealing girlfriend. And that's probably the best place to start, is with the character of Piper Chapman. She's really our anchor for the show, and we tend to learn the system of the prison that she's in and the system of the world that she lives in through her eyes. I'm wondering if she is really the best anchor, knowing what we know now from the past two seasons, if she's really the best anchor for the show. Any thoughts on that, Liz?
Well, I think that there's a big difference between the first and second seasons in that regard. That the first one, which I think was based more closely on the real Piper Chapman's book, never gets away from Piper. Like, it's all about her from every single episode, even though it really is an ensemble cast. And then the second season kind of breaks that wide open, and Piper is not the center of attention anymore, which makes a big difference. And I think as a viewer, it makes kind of a point of view difference, because in the first season, she is kind of us in a way, like an outsider going into prison. And I think it's in that first season that you learn that we're all pretty similar when it comes to, we're maybe not that far away from prison ourselves, literally and figuratively and spiritually. And then in the second season, it sort of moves away from that.
so at the very end of season one, there's spoiler alert. There's that, you know, the big fight between her and Pennsylvania, and that is a moment we find out in season two. That's a breaking point. That's a point where Piper begins to wonder if prison is changing her, or if prison is just revealing her true identity and it's scaring her terribly much. And so she becomes less identifiable to the viewers, I think. So she kind of has to step into the background a little bit, because the deeper she gets, the less ordinary people can relate to her, I think. But that's fine, because there are all these other wonderful characters who get to step into the forefront in season two, and it really becomes much more complex. And it's like almost the newness has worn off for all of us, and we're just kind of in it for season two.
Ate it up. I binge watched it. Yeah. It was awesome. No, I think it's a testament to Jenji Kohan and how she's been able to really create just this cast of characters that you wanted to hear more about. You know, every episode, as I clicked next until like 2 a.m. on my Netflix, you know, whose backstory is next? Who is it going to be? Why, how am I going to learn about their road to get there? What assumptions have I made about that person leading into this that are going to be challenged by the life that they were leading outside of this place? It's like any of those crucible places in our lives where we go to either try to focus solely on ourselves in a way to endure the reality we're living in, or we're going to give over parts of ourselves to it to be shaped by it. And that split happens for Piper. So then we're just able to get into everybody's story in a much deeper way. And I'm always very aware that I'm a blonde white girl watching this show, you know. But then you start to really see just the whole prison movement that's come out of this, like improving prisons and places where they've filmed it. I mean, it's pretty, it gets cultural and political.
And I remember watching that first episode vividly, thinking, I don't know what it is, but I'm starting to get nervous about her going into this prison. I was starting to fear for her. And it seemed like every time something new happened to her, it just seemed even scarier. This seemed like such a foreign world. And it made me wonder, by the time you get to the end of season two, and all of a sudden, it's not a foreign world at all anymore. And I would actually argue that she's morphed somehow from the character of Piper into the character of Chapman. And Chapman has really become a different person because of the system, because of the prison system itself.
Sounds a little bit like seminary, I'll say. Like, seriously, you know, like, you go in pretty self-assured, like, this is who I am, I'm called to be here, I'm going to do this thing, depending on your denomination, whether it's 4 years, 3 years, or how long you're doing it, and, you know, and then you start finding out all these parts of yourself that aren't so attractive, and people aren't going, rah-rah, sis, boom-bah, you want to be a priest, great for you. And you're like, ooh, I don't know how I feel about all this stuff, and you have to come face-to-face with yourself. I mean, you know, there's anything that's going to call you to the carpet, you know, prison's going to do that.
Okay, well, that's an excellent jumping off point for this thing that I've been developing over the last day about how the situation in the prison in Orange is the New Black is a pretty adequate summary of the whole doctrine of original sin. Like, because these women live in this environment where there's so much threat and danger and damage are all around them that every single choice they make is slightly less than the best choice they could make. Some of them are really terrible choices, but not many of them are given the freedom to make the best choice. And that just feeds off each other in that kind of networked, holistic way where it just keeps everybody in a kind of suspended animation of hazard. So there's something in there for me as a priest who thinks about how to talk about these things a lot. That's something about the sinfulness of fallen creation.
How much agency do the people that are honestly just trying to survive in a system, how much agency do they have over the choices that they make? I feel like the question to me seems to come from this. does sin stem from desire? I'm not sure. I think that there is something there about sin, but it feels like sin isn't coming from the community of women that are gathered here. It feels like sin is coming from the system that they're trapped in.
Well, I think it's almost holding the sin of the system that it's a level of what is greater. You know, we haven't really, have we really run into somebody who's in the prison who shouldn't be there or wasn't doing what they have been at least closely accused of doing? I mean, they even joke about it in the opening episodes. Oh, yeah, we're all innocent and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there is the assumption that everybody's screwed up, you know, and that whatever, nobody's buying that you didn't do what you did to get in here. And then it's just about survival at that point.
This idea of judgment, I feel, permeates the show, and I feel like it does it in a way that it actually puts judgment on the audience first as we encounter the characters on the show. Specifically, I'm thinking of the first time that we're introduced to Crazy Eyes, which seems to be a pretty straightforward character when we first meet her. And over the course of several episodes, we start to realize, no, there's a lot of complexity here. But your initial judgment is what kind of you hold in your mind when you first meet this character.
I don't remember everyone's name, but Crazy Eyes is certainly one of them. The one that to me was the most revealing is the woman who drives the van. Her backstory in the second season was heartbreaking. And the one I saw online more reactions to her backstory than almost anything. But it was a moment when assumptions were completely flipped. And she was complicit in the judgment in the sense that she's perpetuating a false story. She's perpetuating a false backstory. And then the writers go on to reveal the true story. So I think it's the genius of the writing. And it's also revealing again of how close we all are to really messing up.
That's something that Fisher says, the sort of naive young guard says. You remember she's holding the ladder for Chapman while she's changing a light bulb or something, and she says, this really could have been me. Like, the only difference between me and you is that you got caught and I didn't. For just a second, it really blurred the lines between the humanity of the guards and the humanity of the inmates.
I love the complexity of it, and I love having the rug pulled out from under me because we are all more complex than we think we are. And oh, yeah. And having characters who have all those layers like onions and ogres is really good. I mean, it makes the story why you tune in for what is the next thing she's going to peel off.
I think that one reason why this show is so popular, and Laverne Cox is a part of that, and so is everyone that we're talking about, is it's an all-female cast. It's completely female-driven with fabulous writing and great backstories. And that's so rare. And it's not just women who are grabbing onto it, although it maybe mostly is, that women are so hungry to see compelling, nuanced stories about our lives and our relationships and ourselves portrayed well, that as soon as that happens, it does. It becomes, you know, a movement.
So let me talk about one other thing when it comes to this show. And this is really the thing that, you know, every time I see an episode of this, this is the one piece that I come away with every time. And that's the overarching threat of loneliness and isolation that exists for every character on the show, whether it's the women in prison, whether it's the people that they've left behind in the real world, you know, like Larry, like parents, best friends. For the guards, for Healy, who can't even relate to the person that he lives with at home, who's searching for common ground no matter what, to Caputo, who plays in this sad little rock band in this really rundown-looking bar and is afraid of people seeing him for who he is. This threat of isolation, this threat of loneliness seems to permeate the whole thing. How do you see the role of loneliness in the show?
Well, I think it's interesting that the women inside of the prison are having more authentic relationships than the people who are moving inside and outside of it. That, you know, the guards and Healy, for example, it's the women in the prison that are falling in love pretty truly and sharing their vulnerability and struggling together. And of course, there's bad stuff happening. Obviously, there's violence and there's jealousy and everything, but they're engaging on a pretty deep level just of human to human relationships, whereas the guards, their personal lives are falling apart. They're totally suffocated by their loneliness.
I think it says that that human need for community. You got to have a family and a community. Even when Red was exiled from the kitchen and nobody wanted her, girls didn't want her, you know, and then she's sitting there with the Golden Girls at the table, and she initially resisted their invitations and then eventually gives in. And that it's the wanting to have community in that way. I mean, I see it in school ministry when people have come to a school yearning for it to be so many different parts of their family's life. You know, is there a group of moms that get together or a group of dads that get together? Is there, you know, all these sorts of social facets that my child's school can fulfill to the point where you end up at a school that has a parochial bent to it. And I have parents who regularly came to chapel services that their second graders attending, and that's church for them. And that, because they are looking for some way to really tap in and be intricately involved in a community. They're seeking it. And I think we want it. We want it. And I think that churches, organized churches, are having a hard time figuring some of those pieces out. But it's why some places are really expanding in other ways and are finding great new ways that people are seeking to be with other people in an authentic way.
There are two places that exist in the prison that I think represent two very different poles. One is the shoe. The shoe is basically the devil. It's the biggest threat that there can possibly be in the prison. It's the one thing that makes every single prisoner stand up and pay attention and say, well, I definitely don't want to do that. And I feel like the other pole, and I think this is interesting for our conversation, the other pole, the very opposite of the shoe, is the chapel. If you look at how the chapel lives in the lives of these women, it's the one place where they can be themselves. It's the one place where they can have authentic sexual relationships. It's the one place where they can be a group together. It's the one place where they experience joy, where they experience happiness. It's the one place where they're human, whereas the shoe does everything in its power to strip them of their humanity.
So you've got the shoe where people are by themselves, and it's the absolutely the most miserable experience on the show is when people are in the shoe. On the other side, I think arguably the most content, most placid, most enviable character in the entire show is Cal, Piper's brother, who's always out in his little trailer out in the woods. He's always very cheerful, very placid, and he's isolated. So he's off by himself. The people in the shoe are by themselves. So it's not just the fact that they are alone that's the issue. There's more to it than that. There's the surroundings and I would guess arguably the choice. But I've just noticed that, you know, he seems so happy by himself out there, and then in the shoe, people by themselves are literally going crazy.
Hal's gotten engaged now, right?
Oh, he gets married. No, he gets married at the wedding.
Yeah, right. He gets
married at a funeral.
That was absolutely that. Can we talk about that scene as the clergy folks here? That was my worst nightmare that I never knew that I was having. Would be someone switching mid funeral into a wedding. And what was this priest doing? He just stood there kind of like, well, okay. You know, what are you going to do?
That actor, you know, obviously he hadn't done enough to earn his SAG card, because any priest I know would have jumped down and just started railing.
Yeah.
My body, it scares me. Guess that I could go out to see a show, but other people scare me too. This isn't anything new.
Another segment, we talked about something that we really like, that's critically acclaimed. time for some confessions. This time around, we're going to talk about some things that we really like that are not necessarily critically acclaimed. What are your guilty pleasure?
Forgive me, Father.
Pieces that exist in the world. We're going to go round table with this. We're going to start with you, Betsy. What's your guiltiest pleasure in pop culture?
It's got to be Kardashians, Greg. I mean, I don't understand it. I can't even give it any sort of like research for some, you know, religious thing, like for something. I watch it.
Do you watch it in a judgmental kind of way? Do you watch it with the idea of, oh, I can't stand these people, but I've got to see what they're up to
right now?
No,
I think I watch it in more of a, because I'm a big family systems person. So for folks who haven't been in a lot of therapy or read that guy's book that we all had to read in seminary in pastoral care class, family systems means graphing and studying the patterns of a family and seeing where different things are going to arise for perhaps the person that you are counseling. And so I watched that show in a very family systems kind of way. Where are things repeating themselves? How is this family, you know, this misunderstanding that's happening here? And I try not to think about how much things may or may not be kind of scripted for my value. And there is some looky-looness of it, of the trips and the houses and the things like that. But I think it's more that I come back to it for some of the watching the family work itself out.
Can you beat Kardashians, Liz?
I don't watch the Kardashians. In fact, after all these years, I still can't keep my Kardashians straight. I'm totally aware of Kim Kardashian. The other Kardashians confuse me. So my guilty pleasure, 100%, three words, Pretty Little Liars, ABC Family.
Oh, wow.
Pretty Little Liars. I don't know if I've ever seen a single episode.
Oh,
can you catch us up to speed on the phenomena that is Pretty Little Liars?
It's a high school drama about a group of friends who are being tormented by an anonymous stalker because one of their friends was killed and buried in their backyard, or was she?
Or was she?
I'm not going to tell it for you. The problem with it is you're always trying to figure out who the anonymous stalker is, who goes by the initial A. And as the show keeps getting renewed season after season, you know, the jig is up. They're never going to tell you who A is. You're never going to know. I love the drama of the teenage world, which is so different from anything resembling my own teenage world.
I've got to jump in and do mine first, so that we can end with you, Chris, because mine is terrible, and I don't want it to live out there for very long.
Don't take mine.
My guilty pleasure is professional wrestling, and I can't even defend this because this is a horrible, horrible show I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed when my wife walks in and I it's like I'm watching some kind of softcore something on HBO. Like, I've got to immediately change the channel. But there's something that I just find fascinating about it. And the way that I rationalize it is that I feel like there's something about it that's a throwback to vaudeville entertainment, where we're all sitting watching something that we know is predetermined, is not on the up and up at all. And yet we all buy in to whatever's happening on the screen.
You have tried to justify this. Share with everybody the paper you wrote in seminary about wrestling. What was that, friend?
I wrote a paper about wrestling and how it is akin to a religious experience where, you know, you get a congregation of people who are all gathered together who are really participating in something like a worship. The problem is that what's being worshipped at the altar of professional wrestling is violent retributive justice. That's what everyone is there to see. That's what they all love.
He made good points. There's a procession. There's a song. People walk in. You know, the action in the altar ring happens, and then they process out, and there's a song. Like, it was pretty good. You did a nice job with that.
Well, thank you. It bears the trappings of something religious, and yet at the very center of it, there's something very, very unholy. And I'll just leave it at that. And Brett, what is your guilty pleasure?
I think Greg just watches wrestling to bring family systems theory to the tag team matches. So my guilty pleasure, my biggest guilty pleasure, I have to say, is the one Catherine Elizabeth Hudson, otherwise known as Katy Perry. I'm a huge Katy Perry fan, and I have been for years, really since California Girls. And then I went back, and you know, I don't think I have everything she's ever recorded, but I have enough. I still remember one day, not too long ago, when I was driving up to the cathedral in Topeka for an ordination, and I had my sunglasses on, and I came rolling into the parking lot of the cathedral with all the windows down, and Katy Perry's number one single, Dark Horse, absolutely cranked up like it was breaking the windows loud. And I came around the corner, and there's the dean of the cathedral, like, just staring at me. Who is this guy? Who is this thug priest? It's got a really good bass line, though.
Katy Perry, PK, right?
Yep, priest. Yeah,
I thought so.
Yep.
Good Christian
Pentecostal,
girl.
Pentecostal parents.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, you guys. This has been an excellent show, I think, and it can only get better as we mine the tremendous field of popular culture and figure out how it intersects with our religious lives and the lives of the people that we minister to. Once again, Betsy Gonzalez, thank you for being here. This is Ethan, thank you. And Chris Arnold, thank you. And we will see you next time on Poppin' College.
Keep those
Thanks, podcast
pop.
Listeners.
Keep it pop.